This is Joseph Gervasi. I'm sitting here with Glenn Wallace of Rune. It is February 20, 2013. We are recording this interview at my house, and this is part of the Loud, Fast, Philly series. Hello, Glenn.
Hello.
Hi. So I guess to begin, we'll talk a little bit about your upbringing, you know, where you came from, you know, a little bit about your early life, if you'd like.
How early? Beginning.
Once upon a time, you were a baby. Did you grow up? You didn't grow up in Philadelphia. Right?
I moved to Philadelphia when I was 11 or 12. South Jersey, really.
Okay.
My parents separated. My father moved into the city. I moved in the city with him when I was around 15 or so.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been, you know, living in Philly more or less since I was 15. Moved out of the city in like 86 or 87 or so.
Mm-hmm. And did you move
to away? I moved to Germany.
Oh, okay.
Right. At that point, to study. And, no.
Okay. So you came in at 15. What year were you born?
I was born in 58.
Okay.
So that was, you do the math.
all right. So that is sometime in the late
mid-70s.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So at the time that you moved, this is probably prior to the existence of punk.
It was just prior to the existence of punk.
So were you actively interested in or involved in music prior to?
Music, when I discovered music is like when I came alive, and that was Rolling Stones, you know, in sixth, seventh grade. By the time I moved here to South Jersey, I actually became friends with Vasco then, and we very early discovered that we had a shared interest in music. The music was, you know, Alice Cooper, you know, prog, I guess, I don't know if we're so interested in the prog rock bands. We were actually more interested in kind of stuff on the periphery, even back then, like, you know, Black Sabbath, Alice Cooper in the early days. I'm forgetting now who it was. Quickly, we discovered bands like the New York Dolls and Iggy and the Stooges, and that stuff really animated us. But yeah, music was very important from very early on.
What part of Jersey were you in?
South Jersey, Medford.
Yeah. Okay.
Mm-hmm. And it's my brother who plays guitar in the band, and Tom or Vasco, also in Medford.
Okay. So when punk comes along, is it a revelation for you? I mean, as it was, you know, for some people,
yeah,
how did it affect you?
I actually, it's funny that you asked that, because I started reading about it first. I think, you know, reading about these bands like The Clash and the Sex Pistols, seeing pictures where it looked really cool and interesting. And I was really excited when Nevermind the Bollocks came out. I ran to the store, got it the morning it came out, came home, put it on the turntable, and was deeply disappointed.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What was your issue with that record?
It just sounded like rock and roll to me. I mean, there was elements of it that on several listens I started to like, the lyrics, the snarl in his voice. But I really expected something different from the descriptions. What I expected turns out probably be something like more like the Ramones.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're talking about just the bigness, the loudness, the intensity, and I just didn't find it in the Sex Pistols.
Right. So had you not heard the Ramones at that point?
Not at that point.
Right.
And I'm not exactly sure the chronology of all this, but I'm pretty sure, you know, I may have heard, I think The Clash came out after that, but shortly after that, I loved the British release of the first Clash record, which Vasco turned me on to. I started going to the Hot Club, which I'm sure has come up.
Mm-hmm.
I actually lived on 21st and Chestnut. Where was the Hot Club? Like 23rd and South, or
yeah,
24th
and
South?
Around there, yeah.
I was just walking past it one night, and it must have been what, late 70s, the Hot Club?
Mm-hmm.
When was it? 77?
Late 70s.
Or,
yeah.
It was early days of punk, anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, I just heard something coming out of there. I went in there. There may be six, seven, eight people just sitting around here and there. And I remember there was a band from New York called, I think they were called, what the hell was it? I don't remember what they were called. But it was kind of an Iggy-ish kind of guy. You know, he had platinum hair and, you know, no shirt and just loud. I loved it. It was just, I started going to Hot Club regularly after that.
And what was Hot Club like, if you could kind of describe it?
Well, the Hot Club in the beginning was, for some reason, whenever I went, there were very few people. There was just, it was bare. I remember some bleachers there. There was a bar somewhere. Was it over there somewhere? And there was just a stage with a bare sound system. And I never saw a real crowd in that place until, if I remember correctly, The Cure played there. And again, I'm not so sure about chronology, but I'm not sure when did The Cure tour the first time.
Yeah, I maybe late 70s or very early 80s. Okay. I wouldn't really know.
So maybe but I remember that was the first. I was surprised about how packed it was. This was The Cure when, I forget his name, the dude's still skinny.
Robert Smith.
Yeah, Robert Smith was skinny. The all in leather bass player, I remember his back was turned the whole time. But that was the first time I saw the place packed. I remember shortly after that, I came and I see all these guys with the kind of the new age, the new wave look.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like,
skinny ties.
And it was the Penn students, the Temple students that started hearing about all this. And I thought, it's all over now.
So prior to it all ending, did you get a sense, this is something I've asked a few of the people who were around, at the start. Did you get a sense that this was the thing, like that you were witnessing a great?
No, not at all. I mean, I knew it was different from the shows I saw at the Spectrum. Aerosmith and bands, bands like that. Yes, but there was. I guess I just wasn't. I just it never occurred to me. Maybe I was too young. I didn't have enough of a sense of the span of history or something to think that this was the next big thing or anything. I just thought it was a cool development. I remember when I first heard the Ramones, I thought, yeah, that's what I had in mind. That kind of music. I thought it was very exciting, but I never thought that Ramones would end up in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame or anything like that. I think I just read recently the Dead Kennedys, one of their albums, the first album that finally got like reached gold status and took all these years, but still. Now there was no sense of I can remember that this was anything like historically important. I never had that sense. I just loved it and was happy it was there. And I hated the music of my youth, like on the radio. I went to this high school for a little while, and then there's a jukebox, and then I just hated everything that came out of there. So I was really happy that I had some music I could listen to. Mm-hmm. Now there's no sense of like historical importance.
Now, do you see now sort of the sort of importance of you having been there at the start of this thing?
Yeah, now of course I look back and I feel like I was actually there at the beginning of something that did have historical importance.
Mm-hmm.
And it's you read Ligotti there, huh?
Yeah, you like that.
And that, I try to talk to my daughters about it. I have a 13-year-old and a 24-year-old daughter. And, to them, it's part of the history of music. And it's an interesting epic. So they also find that interesting. So that makes it even more interesting for me. I was there at the beginning and I saw this band and this band and this band for, the first time they came over when they were young and skinny. And
mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think this is all really important stuff because, say something like this, a year from now, a 15-year-old kid from Indonesia will be listening to this interview. To have kind of like a very intimate perspective of like having seen something grow that miraculously in some form or another still exists today. But we can kind of get into today a little bit later, but we'll go back to initially, did the band speak to you in any kind of like a political way? Did they kind of gel with maybe your personal politics of the era?
I think what really spoke to me was just the vehemence, the power, the intensity, the passion of it, the heat, the rawness. That's what spoke to me. I liked what the Clash were doing. I liked this band. I don't know if you ever heard this band, Sham 69.
Oh, yeah.
They were very political. And I guess it did speak to me in a sense, the political aspect. Some of our early music we wrote had little sort of political stuff going on. So in a way, yes, it did, but not in the way that it didn't take the role that there was like a political faction, the punk, but it didn't. The political wasn't that important to me as it was to that political faction.
Right.
It was really I guess the attitude of it that really struck me. It resonated with, you know, my own anger and anxiety and interest, which I still have for, you know, this is passionate action over refinement and, you know, sort of technical ability.
Right. Yeah, because certainly the feeling is that if you want to be in this sort of band, you can do it. That you're not being held back.
Well, that was a great aspect of the whole thing. The spirit. You know, I had friends who were like guitar virtuosos, and they studied and they knew all the details of guitar, and you know they were still mastering their guitar, and while we were quickly writing songs and getting up on stage and playing.
Yeah, yeah, and recording records while the guy's still trying to be Steve Howe.
It's exactly.
Probably.
It's true. Exactly true. That was looking back to probably an important cultural breakthrough that, I mean, I don't know. Maybe there were other periods of art where there was this kind of spirit of what we now call, you know, DIY, but it really took hold back then in a big way. I mean, so like people all the way through had that spirit. People booking clubs, starting bands, you know, starting record companies.
Mm-hmm. So you witnessed obviously the birth of punk and then this transformation of a sort, hardcore. Now, this was something that I talked to Cordy about earlier, and then I'll kind of mixing my own thoughts on this, but if you're viewing hardcore as sort of a paring down of punk, stripping away the detritus, the maybe some of the fashion, some of the posing,
mm-hmm.
and then there's an attempt maybe to bring it down to this core, this absolute right. tighter core.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then also, you know, something that he talked about was that in that process there was the desire to, for some bands or some individuals, to find a certain spirituality in there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Bad Brains gravitate towards mm-hmm. Rastafarianism.
Minor Threat.
The Minor Threat is, you know, this is with the straight edge, which mm-hmm. is a sort of, and then, you know, clearly with Ruin, there's Buddhism.
Mm-hmm.
So did you perceive a shift as this thing called punk goes to this thing called hardcore? I mean, did you feel this paring down?
I didn't really perceive it. I remember having a conversation with the guy. We worked in a restaurant together. He ended up playing in this band, Why Die. I think it was this dude in Why Die. And we were having a conversation about some new sounds we were hearing. And he was insisting on calling it hardcore. And I don't know when the term hardcore really took. I know there was
probably 80, 81.
Was it because, I mean, so this is probably around, it must have been around that time. But I remember saying it should be called pure strain, because I was saying it wasn't so much about the beats or the speed of the music or the fashion or lack thereof. It was about a particular form of passion and energy that I was arguing. I remember this conversation we had. It was in this restaurant in Center City. We were busboys, and I was saying it's a pure strain. You can trace it back. You know, it was even there in the hippies and the beats, and you trace back to the romantics, and even back farther than that. It goes back to the Dionysian cults. Mm-hmm. That's the thing. You know, punk got away from that, and there's always some strain in any form of art that will try to get back to it. And he would say, no, it's called hardcore. And I'm like, well, it should be called pure strain. I remember that. So I didn't even hear the term. That was the first time I heard the term hardcore.
Mm-hmm.
Right. What it was to me was just hearing, I think, you know, like, you know, GBH was an early version. I think when I went to the East Side Club and Bobby started with Spinning Records, I think I started, he did a section on what now we'd call hardcore, like the Exploited and Discharge and probably, you know, GBH. But it was very gradual to me, and it was all mushed together with the punk. I didn't see it as a faction or a separation in any way.
Mm-hmm.
And you know too, I mean, you know Ruin's music, it's not hardcore. I mean, part of the you know, one of the issues back then was that there wasn't a lot of, you know, there was like mainstream rock and pop and different kinds of mainstream forms, and if you were doing anything alternative to that, you're all lumped together. You're playing in the same places. So you had a band like, I don't know if you know this band, Sensory Fix, sort of a, you know, pop band, or bands like Stickmen, funk, kind of funky band, you know, playing the same place as the hardcore bands were. That's how we got stuck with that. I mean, that's where we had to play, but...
But it does come through in the music. We have
the elements of that, for sure. Yeah. And we have a couple songs that... We have a lot of songs that have breaks, where there's like thrash breaks. We have some songs that may be very short, just sort of thrash beats all the way through, hardcore kind of beats all the way through. But there's an awful lot of mid-tempo stuff. There's sort of certain pop sensibility going on in a lot of it. So, you know, I never really identified with the hardcore scene or anything. I loved it when I heard it. I loved it, but I never identified with it or saw it as a development or a break from punk or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, in talking to you and Cordy, you both strike me as being, you know, rather erudite fellow, so I wonder if there was ever a certain distance between you and maybe like the more dunderheaded faction of hardcore, which certainly would have been present.
Well,
you know,
we never really, and I think all the guys in our band, you know, are intelligent, you know, and they're not that you can't be intelligent and really into hardcore, but
they're not mutually exclusive. But there's always going to be a faction of like complete dipshits who are going to be there to, you know, punch each other in the head. It's a small faction, but
we were never really. Really, I mean, part of, to use the language of the time, you know, part of the scene. You know, we never really hung out with, you know, went to see bands and went to clubs, but never really identified with the scene. Mm-hmm. And part of what, the way I talked about the music back then was, you know, it's not really about the music. You know, the music is just a form of expression about a whole life. And it's got to be a whole life behind it, and music can be a form of expression of that. But it's that life that's the central thing. So what I saw with like sort of people really into the scene, who really their identities really depended on, you know, punk rock and everything that meant, or hardcore and everything that meant. That we were, I mean, I was like nowhere near that. That, you know, that sense of like this is core part of my identity. Mm-hmm. You know, it's part of how I wanted to express myself. And I think it's true for everyone in our band.
How do you think then the band was perceived at the time by your contemporaries, both in other bands and then, you know, in the scene who were there to see you?
My impression at the time was that we had kind of had a reputation for being, what was the word you often heard? I mean, sometimes you've heard the word arrogant, detached.
Aloof.
Distant, aloof. Right. That's the word I was looking for. Right. That was the kind of thing I would hear.
And were you comfortable with that perception?
Yeah, because I wasn't interested. Right. I don't think any of us were interested in being identified with this scene or anything.
But I mean, you were performing within it, so I mean, to a certain extent, there's an involvement.
Well, sure,
an active involvement.
Yeah, but I mean, a lot of these people form friendships around this, and again, their fashion, their identity, their political view. In the language I would use now, is they became sort of subjects, punk subjects in a way. Mm-hmm. They were subjugated by the whole punk rock ethos and ideology and all. And I was never affected that way. I remember once riding in a van. It was after Black Flag played. It was a Starlight Ballroom, I think, and the manager of our band, David Wildman, who also was the manager of the Kennel Club, he put the show on, so he asked me to kind of, you know, hang out with them and take care of them if they need beer or anything. And after the show, we drove, me and this guy, Black Flag, and some other people drove in a van to a party. I remember one of them was saying, like, you know, you don't look like a punk. You don't look like a punk. I don't know, but I probably dress like this or something.
Right.
I was like, and we got into this same conversation about, you know, why do you need to wear it? I'd always criticize the, what was it called back then? It's Philadelphia College, PCA, right? Philadelphia College of Art.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, why do you have to like look like this artist? So I'd go to the Wooden Shoe, the anarchist group. He's like, why do you have to like, you know, why do I have to notice from blocks away that you're an anarchist?
You can probably smell them from blocks
away. Yeah, the Galois, you know?
Yeah.
And so it was a little bit, now I understand it as a refusal to become a subject of this thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was telling the guy, you know, the in the van that night, like, you know, the music's the thing, right? I mean, you don't have to, you know, become a punk rock subject.
Right. I think for some people, wearing the outward accoutrements that kind of telegraph punk was just like to say to other people that they'd see at a distance, we share a common interest in, you know, in a world that probably wasn't necessarily very appreciative of that. And then through that common interest, you know, friendships are formed. And,
well,
you know,
so maybe in those terms, maybe for me or for us, it was, that wasn't a central enough factor to display. Mm-hmm. A central enough like facet of my identity is that I had lots of interest, and you know, I would have, it'd be hard to telegraph exactly on what basis I wanted to connect to you.
Yeah, right.
You know. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So clearly, Buddhism played a significant part in both your life and in the band, which I think is unusual for bands coming out of that scene in general. But so I guess if you can give me maybe some background on your personal interest in that, and then moving forward, you know, through the band.
My interest in Buddhism goes back really far. Probably, I don't know, if I was 13, 14. Probably maybe 14 or 15. I can't remember exactly, but I had an interest, enough interest that my father, for whatever reason, I remember the first really the book I read on this sort of thing, he gave me a copy of Ram Dass's Be Here Now. Mm-hmm. Bosco's mother had a book on transcendental meditation by, was it Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, and it immediately attracted me. I took it home and read it. It's a long story, but I could no longer function in the high school, so I was put in this back then it was called an alternative school. Now I think that has a different connotation. Back then it was an experimental school. I was the 15th student, so it was very, very small.
So this is probably what, like late 60s?
No, this is high school. Oh, so
this
it's
is like early, mid-70s?
Yeah, 70, like 73, 70, 74, something like that.
So was this sort of a hippie-ish school?
It was back then the preferred term for my generation was freaks.
Okay,
it was a freak school. Okay, which meant you know, these are like the younger, you know, we were too young to be hippies, but we were kind of the next, you know, the younger siblings of the hippies, kind of.
So you didn't major in bongs?
No, we were interested in, well, we, you know, there was a lot of, you know, we were very interested in all that, you know, but the school was put together by these two, there's an English professor, I forget, St. Joe's, and a philosophy professor, and they had, it was part of the movement back then. I think it started in the early 70s, late 60s in Boston. It was called the Free School Movement. Mm-hmm. Sudbury, I think the Sudbury Manifesto was a book that they wrote up about philosophy of education and how you might put together another school like this. So these guys got a hold of that. They put together a school. I mean, really, it was based on anarchist principles. So I went to the school.
Now, your parents, are they on board with?
Yeah,
you know, I mean, they're liberal, leftish.
They are.
Okay.
The therapist, you know, so they were attuned to all this, and my father found this school, and he thought I'd do well and thrive there. So I went to the school, and the first thing they asked me was, "What do you want to study? What do you want to learn?" Because there was no set curriculum; it was all student interest driven, and I said I wanted to learn, I think I said something like about Eastern philosophy or something. So they got this guy from the community, I remember his name was Bruce, I don't remember his last name, he had been an IBM executive and dropped out, you know.
Is this Medford? Or
this was in Morristown, New Jersey.
Okay, yeah.
South Jersey, Morristown.
Yeah.
And so they got him to come in and teach me Eastern philosophy. What he ended up teaching me was from this Buddhist book called the Dhammapada, and he taught me how to meditate.
So is this a one-on-one? Your education is you and this dude?
Yes.
I mean, that's, okay.
Another student joined us later, right. So there are two of us.
So there's no algebra? Or,
oh, no, there's no set curriculum. There's no attempt to to form you in any particular fashion. It's you figuring out how you want to be formed. And that began with, what is your interest? What are your interests? And now let's find some people that serve those interests. So they got this guy Bruce. He taught me Buddhism. He taught me the Dhammapada. And from then on, that was a central interest of mine. Mm-hmm. And then, I mean, I don't know. I could keep going from there on Buddhism. I mean, I ended up getting a PhD in Buddhist studies. So it's been serious interest my whole life. But one thing you might find curious is, except for like those very earliest days when I was experimenting with Buddhism, I've never considered myself a Buddhist. And it's similar to what I was saying about punk rock. I was interested in Buddhist forms of practice, meditation and certain ideas, philosophical ideas or psychological models, working with those, but never sort of the subjugating ideological components. I seem to have some natural aversion to that.
Is it an element of the ritual that you don't find to be appealing?
Well,
I find
the Catholic Mass very appealing. You know, I find high ritual very appealing. What I don't find appealing are the subjugating components. How you, in order to do this, you have to become part of this community with these kinds of ideas and the sacred texts do the thinking for you and that sort of thing. I never had any interest in participating in. Although I did participate, I participated in communities, you know, Buddhist communities and so forth. But I always had a hard time. I never really conformed to them because of the same kind of thing I said about the punk community.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I was participant and sometimes even a leader in these communities. And more recently, I was kind of on this Zen track where when I came back to Philadelphia, I opened up a Zendo at 2nd and Chestnut. You know, I have 20 people coming and I'm teaching them Zen. And then that aversion kicked in. And it's like, nah, I don't want to start, subjugating these people now.
Mm-hmm.
So that was really, I didn't step out of Zen at that point. I started studying with the teacher in West Philadelphia, great teacher in Soto Zen tradition. I studied with her for 5 years. That's when, about 2 years ago, I just stepped out of the whole thing for the first time.
Early on in your path into Buddhism and in some sense of spirituality, was there ever the use of psychedelics to achieve a certain spiritual
sense? That was before. I mean, a lot of drug use before, or maybe in the early days, the beginning with the meditation Buddhism. But from the age of, I had an older sister, so the first time I got high was I was around 12 or so. And I just smoked a pot, acid, That was probably in some way also important part of my curiosity about, what I thought back then were like altered states of consciousness and all that. So maybe that was part of my interest in, Eastern spirituality. I don't like that word spirituality, but
okay. Do you see a validity in your use of psychedelics at the time?
What do you mean by validity?
Do you perceive that had a positive effect on you moving forward, rather than being purely recreational, say?
I mean, it made me very curious about the mind and consciousness and possibilities of human being, what human beings are, what's potentials are. And I remember, tripping. I remember the big thing with me was always, oh my God, it's like, it's all constructed. It's all made up. There are all these rules that I don't even notice normally. And now the rules don't make any sense to me. And then you start coming down. You feel yourself coming back into the rules and the structures.
And they seem really dumb. After that point,
completely constructed. That was what I always found disturbing. It's all made up. It's all constructed. We're making this shit up as we, and it's not really real.
Yeah, yeah. It's hard to take very trivial things seriously if you've seen this great expanse of.
And in that expanse, you see that social norms and etiquette, and I would even, if I were tripping and I see your books and everything, I think like, oh my God, this is a display of his, of his of his person or his ego, or this is just more displays. Like he's all over, you know, Joseph's all over the room. It's constant. And that sort of stuff was disturbing. But it was also, it seemed to me to be very, I've seen something very true. And I still see that as true. I just see it in a different way as being true, that you know, we construct these forms, we agree to them, we operate with them. It keeps things, you know, orderly and structured to a certain extent, although all hell always breaks loose. But
right. And then we die.
And then that's it.
Right.
And even there we have lots of nice, we've constructed lots of nice little stories about what, you know, how you come out of life and death unscathed, you know, into heaven or whatever. And in the drug, while I was high, or, you know, not just tripping on acid, but high, I didn't believe it. None of it made any sense. And that's disturbing when you're young. That can be very disturbing. It's kind of...
Yeah, I mean, if you're doing this at, you know, 12, 13, 14, and your brain still isn't completely formed yet, imagine that would be a pretty intense experience.
I remember the very first time, actually, the first time I really got high was I had to go eat dinner with my parents and my family, and I remember seeing it right there, like, oh my God, the dynamics and the competition, and just becoming more sensitive to what's going on and feeling disturbed by it rather than just sort of unconsciously participating.
It's a sort of a lockstep series of contrivances, like, you know, people are acting a role.
And that is
a transparency lead to
that. That's very disturbing to see that.
Because where do you go from there when you've got to, for the rest of your life, move through this?
So now that you mention, I guess, yes, all that was instrumental and important. I think so. And, you know, to this day, I'm interested in philosophy and, you know, literature on consciousness. And so it's persisted. Mm-hmm.
So Buddhism played some role in the band. I mean, certainly people were aware of the fact. I mean, there was an association with a sect or something?
It was a Japanese form of Buddhism called Nichiren Shoshu. Nichiren Buddhism goes back to the 13th century. It's a form of Buddhism now, I know. I mean, I wasn't really aware of this at the time, but it's based on what you'd call a mantra recitation. The whole practice was reciting a certain phrase, sort of a mantra, repeating it over and over again. Ideas about the scroll and cosmic forces and all that kind of stuff. But it's very much rooted in 13th century Japan. Sort of, there are a lot of traditions that developed around that time. Somehow this particular group, sect, whatever, took root in America. And I was walking down the street one day, I don't know how old I was, 16, 17. I was right on the corner. I remember 20th and Chestnut, some guy says, like, you want to come to this meeting? What kind of meeting? A Buddhist meeting? I said, sure, go. And from then on, I was the first one that came sort of serious about this. So I developed what they called a daily practice, like in the morning and the evening, you do this practice. It was very, very, it gave me a lot of structure. I had no structure my whole life. Like that school I went to, it was a principle that they remained unstructured. They thought structure was detrimental to the development of a young person. Don't give the person structure. Let the person figure out his or her own structure. My family life was chaotic. So, my mental life was chaotic. So this is a very structuring practice. Twice a day I became very, very stabilized, very focused, very, you know, all this complex array of phenomena just became what's in front of me here and just this sound. It was very sort of healing just doing it. I look back now and I say it had nothing to do with the ideological components and the beliefs that were surrounding this. I think it really just came down to making a commitment to do this thing for 20, 30, 40 minutes twice a day. That also, you know, that affected my sleeping, my drinking, my everything, because I wanted to be fresh and be able to do this thing in the morning and in the evening. And then my brother became interested. He played guitar in our band. and then later Vasco, and then Cordy, and then Paul.
So were you kind of drawing them into this?
I guess I was an influence, I suppose. Yeah, I must have been. I was like, this is good. This is good. It focuses you. It settles you, and it's stimulating and creative. And why don't you try it? So there are also elements of it, that had to do with different kinds of, the community and trainings, and it was valuable, I think, for us as young people in a chaotic time. Like, I would never participate in anything like that now.
Why is that?
Well, because it just involves beliefs and sort of social relationships that I'm not the least bit interested in now.
So did you make a sort of defined break with the sect?
Yeah, when I did, it's like what I described about my relationship with the punk scene and what else was, the Buddhism more generally, as I said earlier, was the same here. Was I was always, I have a really strong skeptical streak. So I was, in the terms I would use now, was I was always a bad subject. Mm-hmm. I was doing it and participating in it, but I was asking the questions that caused trouble, and I was disagreeing. And
that's the nail that sticks up gets hammered down.
That's what they say in Japan, Yeah. But we're in America, you're not going to hammer me down, Yeah. They would just give answers that I found unacceptable about why they believed what they believed. And so, when you start on that path, eventually the doubts are going to, Nietzsche says, I don't know exactly how he puts it, in a very comical way, but it's something to the effect that, the thinking person thinks himself right out of the group, mm-hmm. Something to that effect.
Right.
So that's what happened there too. And that was when I moved to Germany. I really wanted a practice, a stabilizing practice, and I tried to maintain it there, but I couldn't. So then I got more interested in traditional meditation at that point. I went to Zendo in Berlin, and that made more sense to me because it was just a seated practice. And we can talk about that more if you want, but it was a clean break with that particular brand of Buddhism. I look back, and I remember we did an interview with, was it Tim Yohan? What was his name? Tim Yohan?
Yeah, Max from Rock and Roll.
Rock and Roll, and it was like right out, it was across the bay, not San Francisco, but what was that? I don't know.
They were probably Berkeley.
Berkeley. He was asking us about this. He was doing an interview, and he was pulling out some stuff about the politics of Nietzsche and Buddhism, and how Reagan and this Buddhist, this Nietzsche and Buddhist leader were.
This sounds very much like Maximum Rock and Roll.
Yeah, and I was like, I don't know about any of that, but I'm not interested in any of those aspects of it. But looking back, I think, it's kind of unfortunate that, I wish I'd been interested, introduced to Zen in the very beginning. The guy who introduced me to initial meditation, I don't know how well you know the meditation communities, but it was more what you would call a Vipassana style meditation.
Yeah, I don't know much about it.
But it was really a stripped down, it would have been very suited to me, but there were no real communities at the time. He would have to go up to Barre, Massachusetts or something, and I just couldn't do that. So This was available, and this is what I ended up doing. Yeah, and the band got interested. Everyone became sort of a common practice. Our first drummer, Rich Hutchins, he was not interested in it. It actually created some tension. He always felt like, that he was being pressured to do this, or that even if he wasn't being pressured, he felt like he was outside. He was on the outside, and it might probably led to his leaving the band. Yeah.
So the band was known by all and sundry as a
Buddhist, it was, yeah.
Buddhist punk band.
Yeah, I mean, we didn't call ourselves that, or we didn't bill ourselves
that. Right, right.
I don't know who started.
Perception.
Yeah, yeah. First time, our first really good big gig was with, is with Public Image at the East Side Club, and I remember Johnny Rotten, Johnny Lydon, he stayed at our sound check, and I talked to him a little later, and he said, "I heard you guys are Buddhist. You know, I wanted to say it sound. I heard you guys sound like. I wonder what a bunch of Buddhist punks sound like." He heard about it.
I mean, there's nothing that's going to come through the music that's going to telegraph we are meditating Buddhist.
There are some lyrics though that do subtly refer to different aspects of the practice, and mm-hmm. talk to Vasco about all that.
Okay.
He wrote those lyrics.
So was there any sort of a friction between the band and the punk scene as far as perhaps some people thinking that, you know, you were engaging in some sort of mind control or seduction into a sect or something? Like, was there any you know, friction between audience and band?
I never heard of any or picked up on any.
Because punks, you know, being generally quite political, can be sensitive to religion and spirituality at times, especially in a kind of supercharged fuck Reagan 80s,
I know. The first time I really caught wind of that was at a Bad Brain show at the Love Hall. And there were some guys out there like kind of picketing it. And I went out to have a smoke or whatever. And they were telling me about, you know, do you know what the politics of these guys are? And blah, blah, blah. And I was like, I'm here for the music, man. I'm not interested in the politics. I can imagine, I don't know. You ask some questions and maybe you can come back and tell me. I don't know what people perceived. You know, I think, you know, we put out these little pamphlets in the beginning with little sayings. They were not necessarily Buddhist. They were from philosophy or literature or poetry. And, you know, it tried to have not necessarily an uplifting tone to it, the sayings, but, or, you know, the quotes, whatever, but a thoughtful one. You know, mm-hmm. we wanted to put out these little quotes that we thought were thoughtful, and we thought the music needed to go beyond entertainment. And one way to do that is to get people thinking about their lives and things like that.
I mean, clearly this is a far cry from the sort of nihilism that was endemic to the early, you know, punk and hardcore, where you had lots of people with serious drug addictions, people who wanted to smash bottles, break things.
It was,
but, you know, that's not clearly.
No, it's probably like close to the opposite end of that spectrum. You know, I don't think it was quite as far on that continuum as, you know, the Christian rock bands that came right. later. But maybe some people perceive that way. Although, you know, I've seen some of these little pamphlets, and, you know, they can be pretty dark too. You know,
oh, the Christian ones are
hideous. So were ours. I mean, I'm saying that it wasn't all just uplifting stuff. It was stuff about...
Yeah, but you're probably not condemning people for having abortions or being gay. You know?
No, nothing so, like
so
that.
Yeah. No, no one's going to have an issue with that because...
It was all more thoughtful. I was a philosophy major at the time, so I was exposed to a lot of, you know, interesting, provocative thought about, you know, and some of that found its way into to our pamphlets. And we, you know, we put up these little posters. We put up little posters, you know, like, you know, not posters, like just little flyers. Just paste them up on signs. Even before we really had a band together, we just put up with an image, some sort of saying, and then ruin on it. And it's a long time before there's even a band. It's just my brother and I did that.
No, so was it a glyph?
That little glyph was on there.
And, yeah, so what was the, was there a certain significance to its...
I just doodled that in class and just thought it looked cool. And I don't know, we started putting these posters up. There was no real thought behind it or anything. I mean, later people told us, oh, it's like this rune or this Chinese character and it means this and that and the other and harmony and balance. And mm-hmm. Some people thought it looked like a swastika.
Probably not your intention.
No, not at all. But it did disturb our first manager, Carol Schutzbank. You know, she was sensitive to that sort of thing. And I remember her having a conversation like, you know, some people, you know, this could be perceived as a swastika. You want to rethink this? But it had no significance or meaning that I know of. And I doodled it, so.
Yeah. So the band ended, what, around 86? 86,
must have been 86 or 87. I'm not even exactly sure. Was it 87? Probably 87.
So was it a petering out due to, you know, different interest, or was there a definitive the band is now over?
I mean, it really was a definitive. Now, I remember about to go to rehearsal and sitting there and feel my body shaking, realizing it's over. It's over. And I remember going to rehearsal and before we rehearsed saying, I think this is it. I think it's over. And everyone pretty much agreed. They had the same sort of sense that, you know, we've pushed this as far as we can now. And plus, you know, we had our lives on hold. You know, we weren't, you know, some of us had some college. I was able to somehow finish college through the whole thing. You know, my brother had 1 year. You know, Cordy needed to get back and finish. And there was a sense that our lives were on hold. We'd done some really, we were out in San Francisco shortly before this. It had some real success, some really great gigs. I remember the manager of a place called iBeam. Yeah, it was a big place. We were playing with his band, Campervan, Beethoven, their big college band.
Take the Skinheads Bowling was their hit.
I didn't even really know their music, but I knew that they were big on the college scene. And
I think it was one of the early videos on MTV. So I
is
think
it
had a fair
punk
of,
even, or I don't even know. It's more
like
kind
it's
of
like a quirky.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't like
college rock.
I didn't like quirky.
It was quirky.
Yeah. So, but it was a good gig, and it was iBeam was a very cool place. It was packed. It was big, and the manager there had been around the music scene for a long time. She sat me down and said, "You know, I've been watching you guys, following guys that see music. Keep doing what you're doing for 3 years and you just may find yourselves attracting the kind of attention that allow you to do this for a living." And I remember being, you know, not excited about that. I remember thinking, you know, 3 more years of this.
Yeah.
3 more years of, you know, driving around in a van with these guys and, you know, putting everything on hold. And it wasn't, at that point, it didn't sound that attractive. So anyway, that might have been part of what was going on. We came back and, you know, we kept at it for a while. We kept gigging in Philadelphia. But there was just like one day. In my memory, in my mind, in my experience, it was like from one day to the next. This is over. Went to rehearsal, said it. Everyone kind of agreed. We went to a bar on like, whatever, 24th and Audane, some Irish pub. Had beers, talked about it, but it seemed to be clear to everyone that it was time.
Mm-hmm. Going back just a little bit, you released the two LPs. Was there any EPs? Or
yeah, there were some little things. There's like a flexi disc, and you know, like on compilations. Mm-hmm. No EPs, but there are other stuff on the discography. I don't even quite remember.
Who was it that released in the U.S. the two LPs? Was it
there was a Philadelphia company, you know, company's too fancy of a term, a guy.
A label.
A label called, was it Red Records, I think? I'd have to look at the record.
I have a Dutch pressing of one of the,
he had them, yeah. He
licensed that.
They were pressed like Harlem, Netherlands, yeah.
Yeah.
And then the second one actually was, bizarrely enough, pressed by Shaunicky Records, which is a, Are they known for like Irish stuff and folk stuff, ethnic music? I've heard it was.
I don't know. Clannad and Ruin.
Yeah, I don't know how. I forget the thinking that was behind it. Maybe they were interested in seeing if, I don't know what the deal was there, but they did the second one. But the company was this guy Dave Reckner, who's the manager of Dead Milkmen, and David Wildman, who was our manager. They started this company called. Oh God, I sure remember what it was called because it was related to their names. What the hell was it called? But David Reckner and David Wildman. I can't even remember what it was called now. But they started this company, and I think it was the first time I saw computers. They had this little office with two very early versions of computers where they were
printing out punch cards or something.
I was a little bit after that, but they were like, you know, they had data lists and addresses, and they were organizing Dead Milkmen's tour through that. And what the heck were they called? Oh, wait a minute. Raw. It was called Raw Entertainment.
Okay.
Reckner and Wildman. Yeah. They did Fiat Lux. I'm not even, must have been. I'm not even sure now. Oh, yeah. Or that must have been through them. I'm not even sure.
Okay.
Did you ask Cordy? He probably remembers.
Yeah, we talked about that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I never know who's going to listen to what interview, if they listen to all of them or what. Yeah, so some of the questions also there are questions that I'll ask that I kind of know something of the answer to, but I assume that necessarily the person that's listening doesn't really know.
That's funny. I'm not even sure enough if that's a raw entertainment record. I think it is, actually. I think it is. I think it's because it's... I think it's like raw 0001, and I'm like, why didn't you at least make it look like it was your 8th or 10th or 40th record? Why'd you have to
give it was there ever a 0002?
I don't think so. Well, you know, David Wildman got AIDS right around that time and died. He died shortly after that, so
yeah, okay.
There was no 2, I think.
Yeah, well, were there bands that you played with or toured with that you were especially close with or you know thought were particularly compelling, you know, live performers?
I mentioned some Philly bands that when I went to see them I was impressed and they made an impact on me. I remember Decontrol. I remember the first, I thought they were really cool. In fact, I think we might have asked them to open for one of our reunion shows. I vaguely remembered we asked Decontrol to. There was a band that they were called something like, there's a heavy metal band called Anvil, right?
There is an Anvil, yes.
So was there a Philadelphia band called Anvil Bitch?
There was a band called that. Yeah.
A metal band.
Okay.
I saw them playing some. They were metal. But uh-huh. I don't know, they had a double drummer or a drummer with a double bass, and it was just kicking metal music. And we got them to play some shows with us at the Kennel Club. I remember that very distinctly because there was a mixing of metal culture and punk culture, and it was really apparent.
So this is probably more towards like mid '80s. That seems to be there's that.
This
time
is definitely more melding. Towards the mid '80s.
Yeah.
You know, that stuff started growing together more. Like I got really interested in Slayer, and I played it to Metallica when I first heard Metallica, the very first Metallica record. I played it to everyone. I played it to Lee Paris. I said I want to. In fact, when we went to the studio to do Fiat Lux, he said, what do you want your guitars to sound like? And I brought him the Metallica record.
Right.
Yeah. And it ended up not sounding like that.
Didn't sound like a Kill 'Em All.
No, that's exactly what I wanted.
Yeah, yeah.
That Mark Springer had a real more of a pop sort of sensibility, so the guitars were sort of very compressed and all. But early on in Philadelphia, the first time I heard Sadistic Exploits, I think it was the East Side Club, I was like, very cool sound, you know. I'm trying to think of other Philadelphia bands. I liked Why Die. God, I'm forgetting the bands.
Were there any bands that were coming through town that
I
thought were really great?
I very much liked Discharge, the English bands. I loved Crass. I never saw them live. Other bands that came... Bauhaus was a cool live band. I didn't care for their records too much. And David, I think David again brought them over for the first time, if I remember correctly. Bought them, I forget what it was, someplace on South Street. Yeah, first time I heard Cure, I loved them. They were raw. They were not the Cure I know now. What other piece? You have to jog my memory a little bit. The Jam, Clash. So, you know, I didn't get to see them till a little later, but still, I thought they were very exciting.
I'm very envious of all of you.
Oh, really?
Your entire list here.
What other bands? Oh, God. I mean, they were almost like, you know, every weekend almost we were seeing bands, and there wasn't such a clear, you know, it happened later. In the beginning, it was just you're seeing a band, and, you know, at some point they started becoming sort of hierarchized,
bigger
and smaller and all that. What other bands? Public Image. I mean, this band TSOL. I don't know if you know them. They were LA
True
band.
Sounds of Liberty.
They were cool live, and I listened again. What often happened was I'd see these bands live and then get interested in their records and be disappointed. That's why I always thought, you know, I really prefer sort of live recordings. I remember the first time I heard Ramones, I was like, that's incredible, man. That's so cool. Just no frills.
Yeah.
I remember once it's still, when I tell people this, sometimes it sounds like I'm telling them about a dream, but I remember very, very early days, it must have been like late 70s, driving down the Jersey Turnpike, and I saw some sign that said Ramones and Dead Boys, and had an arrow, and I remember it turned off, and I followed this sign, and it led to a junior high school where the Ramones and Dead Boys were playing, like, you know, on a Saturday afternoon, sitting down in a auditorium of a junior high school. I'm getting the shivers right now.
I would like to have that dream.
But it sounds like a dream, but yeah, it's actually true.
Yeah, that sounds like something.
It probably cost $4 because I rarely had any money on me. I was able to pay the ticket. To this day, it's just so bizarre. I wish there were some. I could research that because it just sounds so incredible. But it was indeed true. The Dead Boys were very exciting. I don't know, you know, in the early days, mm-hmm. I thought again they were kind of like these old rockers in a way, but they were playing cool music. Yeah, yeah, just not what are they, who's the Orgasmatic? What band is that?
The Vibrators. I mean, not the Buzzcocks.
Buzzcocks.
Yeah. The Spiral Scratch record, and yeah.
All these bands.
Those are great.
Yeah.
So moving in now is 2013, and you've seen the birth of this punk, and through some strange miracle series of permutations, there is a form of this that exists today. Does it seem strange to you, all of these years later, to see that this is still a vital form of expression for young people and others? But I mean, you know, the young people would still be drawn to this.
You mean like they're drawn to contemporary versions of it?
Contemporary versions, as well as
older stuff,
as well as the older stuff too. Yeah, but I mean, it still kind of speaks to young people in a way.
It doesn't surprise me because I think there's something about it that in a way, a healthy, alive youth will respond to, you know, passion and loudness, and speed, you know, and a sort of ethos of anarchy and chaos and, you know, fuck the system. And that's, you know, when it starts getting tame and whatever the form is, art, painting, music, you know, someone's going to rediscover again that pure strain, you know, and it's going to manifest. So it doesn't surprise me. What I find funny and surprising is my music is harder and louder and crazier than my daughter's. Like, Dad, you're still hearing, like, turn that shit off or lower the volume, but it's coming from the 13-year-old instead of my old man.
Yeah, very strange.
But I'm glad it's there. My older daughter was interested in hard and heavy music, so she would turn me on to stuff. We'd listen to stuff together. I was always thrilled that, you know, and it's even better in a way, like the equipment's better, the technology's better, it sounds better. Some of these old bands, even when they get back together, like I've seen stuff on YouTube or seen clips here and there of like Stiff Little Finger. That's another band that really moved me back then, Stiff Little Fingers.
Oh, yeah, they were great.
And it sounds almost even better, you know, the sound's more booming and clear. And I understand that a bit. Like, I feel like I have a better sense of the music now. Like I told you, Ruin, we just rehearsed for 8 hours and all together, all six of us, both drummers. And I felt like I had a better grasp and sense of the music than I did back then. It was all just more kind of, I don't know, it's just, I don't know, it was raw or something. It feels a little more nuanced now. I have a better control over it, a better feel for it. And, you know, if we ever did a live show, I'd want to make sure that we had the sound system and the equipment that really gets the job done. Back then, you're just playing through whatever.
Whatever
you find there, and you're looking at these clips now, and it's a little bit painful sometimes, you know. And it's also a shame that there's a reason that it has persisted, and that is that it was really cool and powerful and dynamic. But it's kind of, you don't always get that on the records and the live clips from the day and the audio clips. So I'm thrilled that it's continued. I love it. I was listening to a bunch of new exploited stuff. It's just, it's incredible. It's better than it was back in the 70s and 80s. You know, the equipment and everything.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I think that that the vitality kind of lives on, and that the DIY ethos kind of shows young people, you know, at a pretty impressionable age, if they're coming into it young, you can do this thing, and you can kind of work all aspects of it. You can make the music, you can make a fanzine, you could put on a show. And to me, and I don't like to bring me too much into the interviews, but these kind of life lessons are really crucial, because I think that people take them forward and know that they can actually do things, and that the impediments that are presented to them are sort of facades. They're false. You can just flimsy, you push them away.
Yeah.
You learn how to do shit.
Yes.
And you take that forward.
I completely agree. That might be, you know, and as you alluded to earlier, that has stayed with me my whole life. So you have that experience as a young person, that you have this idea, you get other people, you know, working with you, you have this creative project. And especially now with the internet and everything, it's even more so.
Yeah, because the ability to network and you know, to telegraph this out to a lot of people.
See, that was all missing back then. So now it's even kind of more, you can do even more yourself. And it is a great life lesson. And it should really, a person can learn very early on that you can make it happen. You know, you can make it happen. The means, you know, are at your disposal. It's just a question of figuring it out and getting a community together that's necessary for to move your creative project forward. And yeah, it's I think that spirit stayed with me my whole life. I think that's part of what attracted me as well back then. You know, when things were, they were still in the 70s, you know, firm structures in place. You know, it was still kind of like the world of the 50s in many ways. I mean, the 60s didn't completely overturn that. And there was a real sense of limitation, what you can do. And punk changed that, you know, changed that. You learn, you know, you can make these sounds on your guitar and get a cheap guitar and a cheap amp. And you find a place to get other guys and find a place to play.
Yeah, and I think this retains a validity today, because a younger person is just looking at, say, like American Idol, and sees this something very false that they know they're never going to be a part of. But once this little germ comes into their head, like, never mind all that bullshit, you can actually make this yourself. You have an amazing means of dissemination through the internet that no one before you ever had. I mean, that's like such a great seed, I think, to be planted in someone's head.
One reason I've marveled at your television here, they won't know. Yeah, so he has a big really television. Big TV. We just bought one over Christmas, our first television. Our daughter finally pressured us to get a TV. She convinced us to get one. And she was watching, I don't know what it's called. It's not American Idol. What is it called? Like X Factor? Or what is it called? Like,
there is a
one,
thing.
One of those shows.
I let me get TV stations in the TV.
Well, that was
but
my,
I know these things exist.
That was my exact response when I was watching that with her. It was like, this person has this kind of voice. What makes him or her think he has to go through this? I mean, he should go start gigging somewhere, and, you know, if he's talented, and why would he subject himself to this nonsense? Yeah, that was exactly my impression.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. I guess if people don't know that there is another world, I mean, the doors have largely been broken open, but not everyone's walked through them, or they haven't seen the door to walk through.
And there's also this idea in America that you can go, you know, from 0 to 60, you can just leapfrog the whole thing, go from being an obscure nobody to famous overnight. Maybe that's part of what drives it too.
There needs to be a little bit of a talent drive, you know.
I mean, back then there was no sense of being able to make that. I mean, you knew you had to play the gigs, and you had to play live, and you had to build on it and build a list, you know, a contact list of people, and there was nothing like that. From nothing to, like, you know, maybe the Ed Sullivan Show was like that earlier. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, super. I think we're good. Pretty set. Thank you very much for talking to me. I thought it was an excellent interview.
Thank you. Thanks.
Let me shut this John off.